Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. We've got a great show for you tonight. From our first episode back in late February to now, we've talked to folks from Maine to Florida, from Paris to San Francisco. We've covered music and journey work, dance and trance, and lots in between. I wanted to take a moment to share some of the highlights of our first season. And at the end of the show, we'll have another new Spirit Muse and Song, this time with the music and thoughts of the amazing guitarist Todd Boston. We've had some very cool musicians on the show, so let's hear a piece we heard back on our March 5th show from Sitara Martine Gercou called Healing. Very first show, an excerpt of my conversation with Chetna Lawless about an unusual class of shamanic helpers. And we're back. This is A Shamanic Life. I'm your host, John Carosella, with my guest, Chetna Lawless. And Chetna, before the break, we were talking about the Laughing Rainbow Mystery School. And I was hoping that maybe we could get into some specifics of your experiences and what these color spirits are like.
Well, the color spirits are so humorous and loving and compassionate. They're very deep and profound as well. They really tell us the truth and give us a lot of energy. They love energy. They love hands-on. You know, when I first started working with them sort of shamanically and starting to show people how to do color essence retrieval, much in the same way that you do a power animal retrieval, my spirits were like, I was collecting the energy to blow into the client. They said, it was like, move over, Rover. Yeah. Let's take over. You know, put your hands. There's one color called Gushing White. And Gushing White brings this emotional healing like a waterfall of love pouring in and flushing through all the debris. Gushing White, I was putting out my hands to collect some essence of Gushing White for the client. Gushing White said, just put your hands on the client. And it was, I could just feel the waves of the energy, you know, moving through, and the clients feel quite blasted. Huh. They love it. It's like a Reiki session. So we're working shamanically, but the colors are energy. They love moving through people. They love playing with people. They love they're very sensory. They're very sort of sensual. They love people to dance and merge with them. And sometimes they're quite ethereal. Other times they're much more physical. Like in June this year, I'm going to do one called the Earth Band. We have over 100 colors, 126. There's even more now. We were just given another set of 21 rays. They come in blocks of 21 rays at a time. And so what we do is we work with one chart of 21 rays at a time. And you start to look at, you learn what each color represents, but then you journey into and you have experiential, you know, moments with each one of them so that you develop your own personal relationship with the teacher. So I might say what Gushing White is like for me, but you could have a totally different experience with Gushing White. One of the colors, the mauve band, we were told, is a really important band for people right now. And mauve is this color that helps people deal with depression and despair. And as people feel overwhelmed and challenged by a lot of the changes that are happening, the mauve ray is this deep purpley pink ray, which really allows you to go into the depths of grief and let it pass. This too will pass. You know, we can't do these bypasses anymore. We have to feel what's happening. And by allowing ourselves to drop into those depths, then the feeling gets transformed into something else. And we evolve and move through our pain and expand. So the colors really come as energies to help us transform and expand. The color called diamond white comes through with clarity, cuts through all the rubbish, lets you see really clearly what's happening. You know, bud green just brings in that juiciness and allows you to feel that renewal when you feel drained and exhausted. So they come as textures and flavors. You can feel them. Some people see them. Some people feel them. Some of them are, you can even taste like strawberry red, you know, forest green, lime green. These essences come to us too. And they all have different gifts to give us. And they love sharing with us. They love giving us individual healings. And all of them are enlightened masters. That's the other thing that I think a lot of people, when they start working with the colors, they're sort of like, well, you know, I had been working with my grandmother. I've been working with my grandmother. But I tell you, it was a quantum shift when I started working with the colors. My grandmother, I love my grandmother. I adore my grandmother. But she had a lot of Christian conditioning. She was often telling us, me and my sisters, hey, you shouldn't be with your boyfriends like that. You know, she had a lot of judgments. You know, I'm like, Grandma, it's a different time right now, you know. And the colors aren't like that. The colors are trans. Let's say they get us to expand beyond our ordinary states. And as we bring in the new energies and we're dealing with all these changes that are happening, everyone talked about 2012. Ingerman's work, she talks about how not that things are necessarily going to change, but our perceptions are going to change. And we have a choice about which track to follow. The colors are laying down the blueprints for the new track. They help us kind of envision the most positive future. They help us deal with, you know, we have rural black dealing with nitty gritty, deep, emotional, painful things, but they help us do it in a really enlightened way. So they're not about all the lovely things. They're like wasted ochre. Go into the depths of your emotional primal pain, but then transform it with the clarity of that master supporting you and that energy. You know, you're not alone in the desert, emotional desert, unsupported, even though you might feel isolated and alone. We are here with you. And you can feel the love of the colors and their compassion. They're with us. They so want to come to the earth, but they need us as humans to invite them to be here, to raise and change the frequencies. So as we work with the colors, we change. It changes us, but it also affects the planet because we're bringing energies from non-ordinary reality into this reality. And we're the grounding. We're the bridge between heaven and earth. We're the ones bringing it through, and then they can play more here, you know. And it's fun to play with the colors. When people start working with our charts, they have an excuse to work with each other. So it creates community between and connection between the people here. So the colors, you know, they function in a lot of ways. They also are really great for doing diagnostic tools and divination. So you can really see what's going on for people.
So can you share, like, what's the process for somebody to understand their color chart? Like when you were talking about bud green, I guess you said.
Yeah.
I felt like the green man just visited me.
Yes.
Right? Like inside my body, I envisioned all these, this tender, succulent, vital greenery just flowing and growing inside of me.
Perfect. You merge with bud green.
Okay, so that's one of the things that you do is you engage with the color and let it express something in you.
Yes, you let it. Well, you can merge. I'll tell you, when you merge with the colors, many things happen. You can receive a direct healing. Lots of times they do dismemberment for people. Many times they return gifts. They do energy work on people. They give a little psychic operations. You know, a lot of people have been helped with the colors. I mean, just miracles have happened. That will be enough for me to say. The colors are here for us. They're here to support us. You can journey to them and talk to them as teachers. You can work with them as divination and do like readings for people. Like you can lay your hands on people and call them to come through. Many times what's happening for me when I'm working with them, I'm with someone and I just feel that teacher come in. You know, we're living in a really strange time where we all have choices and it's where you put your attention. Mm. And the colors give us a lovely framework to start exploring these different ways of looking at the world and perceiving. And what I have discovered about working with these color rays with people is afterwards, people suddenly have, they're creating new paradigms. They're creating almost a new language. They're creating a way of looking at things. So rather than say, oh God, I'm a really screwed up person with a lot of emotional wounds, they can say, I'm having a really wasted ochre time right now. I can really feel the ancient wound is calling, you know, wanting to surface and be healed. Mm-hmm. So it becomes like a thing that's almost objectified and externalized and something that becomes manageable. And also there's a feeling that there's a spirit there that can guide and support me, that I'm not alone with this trauma coming out of my system. Pastel pink is one of those nostalgia for the good old days and getting stuck there. It's like, well, actually, I'm going to draw on the strengths from my ancestors, but I'm not going to be entombed in their negative stories. I'm going to progress forward, bringing the gifts of my ancestral lines and healing the wounds.
You know, this is a really interesting way of, I'll use the word, way of vibrating into your wound or your experience, because they're not static and they're mm-hmm. not formless. Now I see why I was drawn to remark on the difference between the pigment and the color. A pigment, you know, the paint itself, right, is a material essence, right? It's something that is fixed. Whereas the color is energy, it's vibration. So as I'm contemplating the healing process, you just suggested that, you know, when you said I'm having a really wasted ochre time right now, I got this sense that it takes someone from a place of a fixed experience and moves them into a flow experience.
Yes. A continuum of flow.
Right. And so
absolutely.
as this color, as you align your internal experience with the color's dynamism kind of allows you to let go into the color, and the color can carry the load. That's how it supports you.
Yes.
Wow, this is very cool. This is very interesting. because there's energy, there's these things aren't they're not places where you, they're not a cubbyhole that you put something. It's a river that you kind of ride or wash in or something. You know, it's very different.
Save the date. Mark your calendar. Join John Carosella for The First Agreement, Adam and the Power of the Runes, at East West Bookstore in Mountain View on Thursday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Why be impeccable with our words? What unseen powers reside within them? Where does the power of symbol come from? And how does it affect us? How do we bring this power into our awareness and begin to consciously harness it? Join compassionate adventure guide John Carosella on a journey into the subtle sorcery and hidden transformational powers of words and symbols at East West Bookstore in Mountain View, California, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Visit www.eastwest.com/events for details.
That was Water by Nicholas Breeze Wood, who was our guest on Spirit, Muse, and Song back on March 19th. I love the magic of that song. Hear Nick's take on it in the archive. Here's a fun slice of my conversation with my featured guest, Jenny Seek, also from our March 19th show.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. With me today is Jenny Seek. As a practicing intuitive tarot reader, intuitive practitioner, Jungian-focused counselor, and shamanic practitioner, Jenny offers her intuitive gifts to help you discover your unique soul path by helping you learn to recognize your higher self. Jenny also has a business called Sacred Bracelets, where she offers commission designs for her clientele, designed and developed using her intuitive connections. I'm sure we're going to hear about that and more. Getting close to the end of our conversation, but I wanted to ask just a couple of other questions. Can you identify something, one of your bigger challenges or significant learning experiences as you've come into this work and developed your practice?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest learning challenge that I've had is that you really can do it on your own terms, like that, you know, and that it isn't about, and actually just recently, because I had a sickness just recently, and my tendency is to go into overdrive and to think that I have to work super hard, and if I don't, nothing will get done. But there's this amazing ability that we have to set our intention and to imagine an outcome. And usually when we can imagine, when I can imagine that outcome without needing to be able to manifest it, I know that I'm on my way to things changing. And so a lot of the work that I've done is about holding that energy and it just, you know, in random moments of time and imagining those different things coming to fruition, like, you know, a client finding you and wanting to do a bracelet around this or something that you've really been wanting and just holding the curiosity about how that will happen and feeling like you're getting closer to that energetic match, so that synchronistic experience where you go, ah, this is popping up again. This energy is popping up again. It's getting ready to manifest. There's a tendency to get into that place where you're like, oh, my gosh, I have to manifest this. And then there's a whole bunch of people who reinforce the idea that if you don't manifest it, you're not really doing the work, which is all just ridiculous. I mean, you just have to get away from that kind of stringency about the imaginative process because it will shut down in when that happens.
Yeah, I think something that you said that is really essential is that you need to that getting to a place where you can imagine it manifesting and imagine the value of it manifesting to you without feeling needy.
Yes, that's huge. That's huge.
So I've taken to say, instead of saying things like I want or I need, mm-hmm. I now say things like I will be delighted when.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Right? Because yeah. I looked through my vocabulary and portfolio of concepts of what is it that I'm actually seeking, right?
Yes.
You know, and ultimately the most convenient place for me to drop all this stuff is into delight. Right?
Yes.
Because do I really need it? Do I really need it? I probably don't really need it. I probably want it, but I mean, do I really want to be wanting something? You know, I'd rather be delighted by my life, right?
Exactly. And curious and excited. And yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the one of the ones that I use. Okay. So, and then another question, do you have top five, can you share one of your top five experiences or one of your most powerful experiences that has come to you as you've done your work, either for yourself or with clients, that's really smacked you and changed your life?
Yeah.
I know you shared some already. You know, you shared the seeing the Seal Cove. That could well be on your top five list.
Yeah. Oh well. I do. One of the experiences that changed my life and in a big way. A lot of my work has been to move away from my parental voices and move away from, you know, the energy of my family of origin to a certain extent. And I guess it was in 2008. I was planning on going on this trip when I finished my thesis work. I was planning on going abroad, and I thought I had funds for it, and I had miscalculated my funds. And so I wasn't going to get to take this amazing trip that I thought I was going to get to take. And I already regrouped, and I was like, okay, I'll go to Niches, and I'll go for a long weekend in a cabin kind of thing, and I'll just put off this other trip, which I had always wanted to go to Greece. Well, I went to visit my family to go see for my birthday, a belated birthday present, and I was going to go see Lorena McKinnitt, who's this wonderful singer who sings songs from different countries and different traditions. And I was going through my parents' computer images. They had gone on a trip to Turkey, and it was then that I realized that I didn't really want to go to Greece. I really wanted to go to Turkey. And I was like, I want to go to Turkey. And it kind of sunk in, and I was like, well, before I die, I want to go to Turkey. Well, I've learned in my own life, as soon as I say before I die, something is going to manifest really, really quick, because it always does. But so I was thinking, like, all the whole weekend that I was there, well, how can I get to Turkey? How can I get to Turkey? Well, I'll create a savings account for Turkey. If I have to use the money for something else, that's fine, but I'll call it the Turkey account. I'll start to make it real in my world. I looked at Globus and found out that if I had 9 people who would go to Turkey with me, the 10th me could get the plane fare free. So I was like, you know, just spinning in my mind, how am I going to make this happen? How am I going to make this dream a reality? Well, we went to see Lorena McKinnitt that night, and Lorena McKinnitt started talking about this amazing trip to Turkey. And I figured out from the order of the places she was describing that she had been on the same trip to Turkey that my parents had been on, because their photos were in the same order of the places that she was describing. So wow. I was like, oh my gosh. So to me, that was like, okay, Turkey feels a lot closer. And yet nothing had happened, right, really, in the external world, but boy, Turkey felt close. So I got home to Columbus, where I live, and I started asking people, have you been to Turkey? Do you know anyone who's been to Turkey? And turned out the woman I was living with, her next-door neighbor had been to Turkey, and she showed me her pictures. And then I was at this women's group, and I said, has anybody here been to Turkey? And they said, actually, there's a group going in December, and that was just a month away, and we need 2 more people to go. And I said, oh, well, you know, I probably can't afford it, just figuring that I probably couldn't. And they said, well, look into it, because it's really, really not, you know, that cost prohibitive. You really should look into it. And so a month and a half after deciding I wanted to go to Turkey, I got to go on a 10-day trip to Turkey, got a flight inside of Turkey, and was hosted by all of these wonderful people. It was with an organization called Bakiad, which is an organization that creates tolerance between Muslims and Christians. And that was how I was able to go on this trip. And we were just wined and dined. We stayed in 4-star hotels, and
wow,
they fed us wonderful meals. I mean, the trip was, it was hand-stamped for me.
And so, very cool.
And if I had said what my family of origin would have said, which is, oh, well, you know, that's not going to happen, and that's not possible, and, well, you know, you really have to look at your plan. I mean, if I had come at it with the, you know, the whole, well, this can't be because it won't fit for me kind of thing, I never would have found that. I never would have asked those questions. I would have set it aside and said, well, this is something for another lifetime or 10 years down the road. I wouldn't have kept the dream alive in me in the way that I did.
That's beautiful. That's a great story. Okay. All right. So is there anything, any last thoughts you would like to share with our audience before we go?
Just to trust your visions, trust them no matter how offbeat they are, how irrelevant they may seem, no matter how much support, that's really what I want to say, no matter how much external support you have for your visions, really trust your visions, trust your dreams, trust your numinous content, and find support for in your corner of the world for for those dreams. It's really important that you have someone to dream with as well. So that's what I would say.
At Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest, or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Gentle Thunder. Gentle Thunder makes such magic with the hammer dulcimer. She was our guest for Spirit Muse and Song on our April 16th show. Now, from our April 2nd show, an excerpt of my conversation with featured guest Evelyn Reisdijk. With me today is Evelyn Reisdijk. Whether through face-to-face contact with individual patients, workshop and conference participants, or through the printed word, Evelyn uses her loving humor and passion to open people's hearts and inspire them to live more joyful and purposeful lives. She's an internationally recognized shamanic teacher, healer, and speaker, and author who delights in supporting people to remember their sacred place in creation. Okay, so let's get down to some nitty-gritty. Your latest book, Spirit Walking, you said it helps people, gives people some grounded tools. Why did you write this book?
Well, my experience of being taught shamanism in Western society is a very different experience, I'm sure, than being guided through shamanism in a tribal culture. I've been fortunate to work with several tribal shamans, and they grew up in a way of being that we as Westerners did not. They grew up with an understanding that they were woven into a world of spirits in the way that we didn't experience in this culture in the United States. And so supporting people back into relationship, I think, is the challenge, and also the way that people can develop much deeper shamanic power, for lack of a better word, that place where, you know, if you're with somebody who's got a long tradition of shamanism in their tribal background. They live it, breathe it. It's a part of their everyday experience. They know the world through that lens. It's not something that they do as work or do as a sideline. It is who they are. And what is intrinsic in that is the fact that they're in relationship with the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so supporting people who don't necessarily have that way of being at the heart of their culture, at the heart of their family, at the heart of their experience, guiding them back into being in relationship. And what that means, what does it mean when suddenly you're now in an environment where everything around you really is alive. It's capable of being in conversation with you, and that you then have all the responsibilities that come with being in relationship. You have all the excitement and joy of being in relationship. But, you know, I think it's because we don't necessarily do human relationship very well in our culture that people need to be supported back into that, because it is an old way of being. Our ancestors certainly lived in the world that way when they were hunter-gatherers, but we have forgotten, and so we need some support to get back into that. It's not, you know, shamanism isn't about a bunch of techniques that you learn. It's that the techniques can lead you back into that way of being, that way of being in connection.
So you use the term reverent participatory relationship. What is a reverent participatory relationship?
To me, it implies that you are, you know, that wonderful gesture that they do in the Far East where they clasp their hands in front of them, their heart, and they say namaste. We saw a lot of that when we were visiting in Nepal. Namaste, the divine in me is recognizing the divine in you. That is that sense of reverence. So there isn't that idea that I'm more or less important than any other part of creation. It's about recognizing that every being that we interact with has wisdom, has a consciousness, has awareness that may be different from ours, but it's equally as important. So that's that piece of reverence for me, that we're both, if we're interacting with one another like we are, you're an aspect of the divine, I'm an aspect of the divine, and we have an opportunity to get to know each other. Participatory is that relationship is something that you have to not take for granted, but be interactive with. Tribal shamans are brilliant at being interactive with the spirits. They just don't just go and ask for something. They're always in that place of offering food. They're doing ceremony for spirit. They're doing that giving so that they receive. There's that sense of you have to participate in the process. You don't just sit back, ask for something, and then you get it and you're done. You have to be in that wheel, what the people of the Andes call Aini, which is that sacred reciprocity. It is a participatory event. So that is the place where I come when I talk about being in reverent participatory relationship. It means that it is an interaction, and that interaction has to be done in that atmosphere of mutual respect, of being open-hearted so that you are able to receive who that other being is, and being open-hearted so that the other being can perceive who you are.
And so how do we, you have some advice on how we as modern humans can do that reciprocal part? I mean, you know, those of us who do shamanic journeys and have relationship with spirit, we often do exactly as you identified. We go to them when we need something in particular. If we're doing healing work or divination work, we go and ask for help. But what are the things that we can be doing as regular folks, not just shamanic folks, but as regular folks too, to participate in that, you know, what can we give them?
Well, like any relationship, I think it's best to ask. You know, if you want to be in a good relationship with your partner, your spouse, you want to find out what it is they enjoy. You know, you have to engage in that way to find out, well, what is it that would make this relationship work better for you? I'm more than willing to share my needs, but I need to also hear yours. And then be willing to offer what it is that is needed by that partner, or what is that desired by that partner. It's really like, you know, we talk about falling in love with the world or being in love with nature. Taking that a little more literally, if I am in love with nature, if I'm in love with the tree that's outside or the birds that come to my feeder, how is it that I can express that love rather than just having an internal experience of that love? How can I make that love something that is an expression of who I am, an expression of that relationship? And, go ahead.
So in a way, I have been coming back to this metaphor quite frequently. In a way, it's like the way a gardener loves his garden.
Yes. Yes. Or that you would love, you know, if you have a pet that you adore, you know, your dog or your cat or hamster or whatever it is you happen to have, you take good care of that being. You know, you do things to make their life smoother, gentler, more comfortable. So beginning to think about those things, and it does require a little mind shift to think of all the beings that are around you have needs. They have wisdom. You can step into relationship with one at a time. You don't try to do it all at once because you'd be completely overwhelmed.
Right.
But just to be in relationship with one in that deep way is so nurturing for the one that's in relationship. So I'm thinking about myself. It's nurturing to me to be able to provide for the birds that come and give me such incredible joy.
Right.
Especially the ones that stay all winter here in Maine.
Right.
You know, to make sure that they have food, they have the bird bath has a heater in it so that the waters flow all winter long and they get good suet and they get good food. It's a very simple thing, but it's my way of giving them something for all that they give me, because nature always gives to us. I'll
yeah.
use nature as an example. It's always giving to us. So anytime you appreciate it by giving back, that helps to make a connection that is very palpable, at least to me. Inside my body, I feel much more connected to those beings around me when I put a piece of action in place. And I think that's why tribal shamans do so much ritual and ceremony. They do literal physical offerings of food, of sweets, of alcohol, whatever it might be, depending on the culture. Sometimes it's just incense. You're giving because you receive so much all the time. It is your natural desire to want to give, to be in that place because you recognize how much you're already receiving.
So really the giving, this is an interesting and perhaps subtle thing to draw out, and that is there's two aspects to the giving that are important. One is the giving based on an understanding of what the other desires.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is giving out of a sense of gratitude.
And I think they go together, absolutely. And again, if we look at a romantic relationship, it's very much the same. If you want to be in a good relationship, you take the other person's needs into account and you give them a gift because you're getting a gift from them. There's this sense of, you know, of course I'll make you a cup of coffee. Thank you for that. You know, there's just this all, you know, it's like you don't even have to keep track of who gave the last thing first. You know, there's this sense of it's just a flow. Each one gives to the other and it's a beautiful flow.
I think both of them are really important. You can't really just do one or the other.
No, I don't think so either.
Because, you know, if you toss the tobacco out underneath the tree because you know the tree enjoys the tobacco, but you're not doing it because you have some gratitude, you're not reflecting on some aspect of your relationship with the tree, that doesn't really seem to be a complete way of contributing to that relationship.
Right. Then you're just sort of doing an obligation, and I don't think an obligation is really relationship.
Right, right. Well said. Yeah. It's like an obligation, fulfilling an obligation as opposed to being in relationship.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned something. You said don't do it all at once. There's so much more to each of these conversations. Up next, shamanic cartoonist Patrick Corrigan, my featured guest back on May 7th.
In shamanism, anything's possible, including high-fiving a salmon. Let's listen. We've been talking about your cartooning and how it's influenced by spirit. Now I want to talk about your shamanic work and what landscape you see when you do your shamanic work. And and that's metaphorically speaking. I mean, when you do shamanic work, what is that like for you?
Well, I get the sense that my shamanic landscape is a little more whimsical than others.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm probing for. Is that the case?
It is, and you know, my spirit animals are just a bunch of goofballs, and you know, I'll be in a shamanic journey circle or something, and people will be talking about these deep, profound journeys they had, and I'll come back. Well, I just met one of Santa's reindeer, you know, and it's at the same time, it's like it's easy to pass that whimsical stuff off as just kind of surface frosting kind of stuff, but I find that. To me, it's the language of my soul. It's like being a cartoonist, being an artist, being someone who's just loves the whimsy and the magic and the enchantment of the world. That's the stuff that speaks to me. And so, of course, I'm going to have spirit animals that come to me that are a little more whimsical, not as serious. You know, like I have a salmon that helps me with soul retrieval. And whenever I get done with a soul retrieval, I'll be like, okay, how did I do okay? And he'll like high-five me.
In a way that only a salmon can.
Exactly. So, it's, you know, I just have goofball for spirit animals. It's just, it's fun. And I think I can see that's kind of where my practice is going, as being a bridge and presenting things in a way that people can, and that people can understand it on a different level.
And Patrick, before the break, you talked about how your landscape, your shamanic landscape, was a little bit more whimsical, and it seems like maybe you're crafting a practice that has some unique characteristics. Tell us about
that. Okay. You know, it's like just this past week even, I got this inspiration. I would love to do, I see myself doing like kids' videos. Like I could see doing a video of like different, how to find your spirit animals and what different animals mean. And I've also, I would like to do a graphic novel about shamanism, explaining shamanism, but in comic book form that I think will make more sense to people. You know, because a lot of times people think of shaman or Magold as weird woo-woo kind of stuff. And I feel like part of my job this time around is to kind of be a bridge to different levels of people and like make things like shamanism a little more accessible and a little more understandable and not so out there and weird.
Well, do you think that it's humor and humor and whimsy that is going to be the actual tool for bridging?
I think so. You know, everything. People learn better. You know, laughter is the best medicine. And
well, that's for sure.
When they're laughing, when there's something funny, you know, and there's, you know, no matter what the joke is, there's always that little element of truth. And it's kind of, you know, my other passion is I love stories and I love the meanings of stories and this. And when I, you know, I kind of see this kind of along that same lines as bringing these deeper meanings to people through stories. You know, even Jesus had his parables and you know,
yeah.
I think the soul is bridging that, not only bridging between people, but bridging that gap between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind, you know. That's why our souls speak to us in dreams. You know, everything's kind of metaphoric and symbolic. And the more you can get in line with the flow of what, you know, your personal images is, your personal mythology is, the better aligned you are, the better in sync with your own self you are, I think. And so that's kind of where I'm headed with my comics and stuff, is to try to get people thinking about their own stories, what is their real, what's their connection to spirit and all of that.
Well, it's interesting you say that because on the program, we've been doing a series with Annette Wagner. She's taking us through something that is called the Vision Plan. And, you know, it's eight panels, which are, in a sense, it's an eight-panel story or cartoon or graphic novel, if you want to call it that.
Uh-huh.
And
one of the panels is called Legend.
Oh.
And the panel is where you describe your personal legend. What,
oh, cool.
if you were eavesdropping in a room and people were talking about you 5 years into the future, what mm-hmm. would you ideally want to hear them saying? What story would be told about you that would indicate that you had fulfilled something important, you know?
Uh-huh.
And you know, a personal mythology, a personal legend is, I don't think we have a lot of that in our culture. That not a lot feeds that in our culture.
No, no. And I think that's one thing that's really missing from our culture is, you know, it's such a, we're in a time right now where there's so much communication, you know, that the world's become so small that we have so many cultures and so many stories to draw from that it's time, you know, it's taking all of that and reflecting it back in and coming up with our own healing stories for who we are and our own stories for how to connect with spirit, you know, whether we're borrowing, you know, Greek gods or Aesop's fables or whatever it is, you know, whatever imagery works for us, kind of like building that personal mythology of who we are. You know, I took medicine for the earth.
Would you like to share your shamanic life with our audience? We're always looking for featured guests who aren't just doing shamanism, but living it. If you've got stories to tell, let us know. Your stories can illuminate the path for others. If you're interested, contact us at facebook.com/shamaniclife or send a message to Karen Armstrong, K-A-R-Y-N, at shamaniclife.com or John Carosella, J-C, at fireflywillows.com. We're ready to listen.
Next up, a slice of my multi-part conversation with Annette Wagner. We talked through the powerful work Annette does in helping clients craft a vision plan, part by part, starting back in March. In this segment from our June 18th show, we uncover the secrets hidden in the word abundance. Abundance. You know, when I say the word abundance, I think of the Italian word abbondanza, which usually is a big, like three or four picnic tables strung together outside, covered with tablecloths, and the extended family is sitting down for some big old meal.
It's loaded with food and wine and chatter. And...
Right. It's, you know, and it's beautiful outside, and there's a breeze, and there's food everywhere, and there's love all around, and there's play, and there's laughter, and there's music. And it's like, you know, that's abundance to me. And I'm just wondering, you know, like, what is that?
See, when I hear you say that, I hear a lot about community and support and love. And depending on, you know, what you've done your vision plan on,
yeah,
that may be the abundance that you're asking for, is to have that in a way what you're describing is, this is a set of people that are sitting around these picnic tables and chatting and eating where the connections between all of you are present. There's this reciprocal energy flowing between everyone.
Yeah.
And it's like it's very present and moving.
And there's material support flowing through those connections too. You know, it's like people bring food, people bring wine, people bring fruit, people, you know, or the host is supplying a whole bunch of this, but it's all, somehow it's all manifesting.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm creating a tally of, you know, like any of the other things that you've mentioned, like, mm-hmm. like how much to charge for a workshop or... what percent of my income comes from, it's not even income related, really. So I still have there's a thing here about this panel. You know, we talk about, there's obvious ways to think about abundance. There's, like you said, there's asking for the material things that you need,
mm-hmm.
but there's resistance to asking for those material things. I think in part because if you're really talking to God here, let's say,
mm-hmm.
all right, you're going to ask God for $150 a session to get paid $150 a session? That, I mean, it seems like there's something that is
I don't know, it seems small to ask for that kind of thing.
It is and it isn't. So let's take it apart and see what we find.
Yeah, let's take it apart.
So the one thread that comes in here and confuses us, especially given, you know, I'm white woman in American culture, right, is we live in a culture that is totally about consuming and materialism.
Mm.
So we get this message immediately when we do something like this, that it's not that if we ask for something like a car or $150 per session, that we're just falling right back into materialism.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so my response to that thread is to say, excuse me, look at the rest of your vision plan. If you're really signing up to do your work in the world and you really believe in it passionately and you're really willing to do the offerings, and when I see people create these things, they're putting down things that are pretty amazing that they're going to go out there and do.
Right.
So my response to that is, it's perfectly okay to ask for $150 a session. It's completely okay to ask for a car if that's what you need to do your work, because you're doing your work. And you need to step out of that thing.
Well, okay. So there's two things here. One is, if you ask God for that, it seems like it seems to me like if I were to ask God for something that specific and concrete, it would presume that I am so clear about all of this stuff that I can be that specific in what I ask for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that really what I need? Does that really represent the magic of abundance to me? Mm-hmm. Or is that just something that I'm throwing out there because I don't really know how to do it any other way? Right, I don't know how to do this without a car. I don't know how to do this without a roof over my head. I don't know how to do this without getting paid for my sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but that doesn't mean that is that really what abundance is, or is abundance really I am free enough to do my work?
The thread underlying both of those things is trust.
Ah, okay. So now we're getting there. Okay. Now we're getting there. Okay. So what abundance really means is that I like this. It's trust. I can trust that my needs will be tended to as I do my work.
Yes. And it once again goes back to engaging. You're basically saying you're going to go out and do this work in the world. I'm admitting, I'm writing down, and I'm making visible to the entire world my promise about what my passion and purpose is in the world. And I'm saying, these are my beloveds, and this is how I'm going to do my work. And I am asking for you to give me these things. And underlying all of that is that a trust that says the Spirit is going to take care of you to do your work. Now, what happens in this is, you do the best job you can when you write your vision plan. You're doing your best job at that time, at that moment, you know, right here, right now. And it may not be what you need to get this work done. In fact, the work that you wrote down that you said you're going to do may not actually be what you end up doing.
Right.
But the fact that you have put your effort into it and you've made the best possible effort to put this down, Spirit recognizes that. And,
right.
And it just... there's a level of trust that happens, and there's a letting go that we have to have of the fears around money, and that's the really hard stuff.
So I think that's, I guess, where I would want to... Now, we need to make something concrete,
mm-hmm.
right? So there is that, right? But it is about saying, in the following conditions, if I am experiencing the following conditions,
mm-hmm.
then I am free to do my work,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's interesting because that abundanza picture that mm-hmm. I talked about would say to me, I have enough. If I can be the host of that party every Sunday or, you know, whatever,
right?
That if I can host that community,
mm-hmm.
then I have enough to do my work.
Yeah.
That is interesting. So you can write down specifics.
Oh, absolutely.
But they don't, but the thing...
Do you have a workshop, protocol, or modality that you'd like to explore with our audience? Come and join us on the air. Share why you love it, how it helps us shine, and empowers us to live more fully. Share your inspiration. You never know who might be listening and whose lives you'll touch. Contact John Carosella on Facebook or by email at jc@fireflywillows.com for details.
Now I want to share with you a bit of music from Stephen McNamara and a bit of our conversation. Stephen was our guest on Spirit Muse and Song back on April 2nd. This is the song Bittersweet, followed by just some of our powerful conversation.
About 17 or 18, I heard a Ravi Shankar record in a record store in Johannesburg, which in those days, that sort of thing was very hard to come by. Anything, any type of music that wasn't absolutely the top, you know, top 40 was imported.
Hmm.
So someone may have imported it and just decided not to get it, and I was absolutely just fascinated by the feeling of that music. Once I heard the classical music, something deep inside really started resonating. And so when I first came to the United States in the early 70s, I happened to be in Boston when Ravi Shankar was coming through on a tour and saw him live.
Wow.
And that was just such a vast difference from a record that that was the final straw, you know, that thing that was budding inside burst open, and I was just fascinated, enthralled by the whole experience.
Mm.
And luckily found a teacher from India who was not far from where I lived, and I started taking lessons.
So what can you tell us about the raga? It's a musical form, right?
It is a musical form, and it's been in existence for centuries. The earliest Indian music, as I understand, came out of the Vedic era, where they used sound and chants in their temples, in their religious ceremonies, and to have certain healing effect on people. I mean, there so many ragas have been created for very specific reasons. And I think the best way to explain that is that the translation of raga is that which colors the mind. You know, I think those yogis were able to perceive this at a higher level than just understanding. They knew the effect of notes played in a certain way, maybe certain rhythms, would have the desired effect on the people participating. So the raga form evolved over the centuries more into what it is now, but the main point of raga too is that it takes one emotion or one particular mood and everything focuses on that. All the music in that particular raga is constructed to invoke and to keep growing that mood until one becomes totally immersed in it. You know, in the Western music, especially even classical, the mood is changing all the time. We have a serious part, and then it'll lighten up and go into something else. It's a lot of music is changing, but the raga focuses on the one emotion, the one mood, the one power.
Mm. And the information that you sent me so that I could prep, you wrote, it's considered like a living musical entity.
Yes. So to explain that, when the ancient yogis who were masters of sound were able to play and perform the ragas correctly, they felt or they perceived the manifestation of the raga. In other words, in their culture, the raga already existed. It was only merely a discovery by a man to, you know, to actually realize that its existence.
Oh.
So, you know, they felt once if a raga is performed correctly, that almost like a deity or a goddess or whatever that power is in nature would actually manifest. I mean, they have ragas, the ancient ragas, for instance, to make it rain. And when certain highly evolved musicians would sing those ragas, rain would come, like maybe the rain dances of the Native Americans or the in other tribal or shamanic cultures. They realized the power of sound to produce certain things.
But this is a different way of thinking about it. I've never heard it described this way, and it's really getting me, Stephen. This is really cool.
Yeah.
It's not that the sound produces something so much as the sound invites the emergence of something that's already there.
Yes.
And I think that
is the key. Yeah.
That is so cool. I will never make music the same way again.
And I think to go back to my music, that I think that's the feeling that is underneath all of this, even though there's more sort of a Western approach to it, or, you know, it seems to be easy for the Westerners to listen to this music, whereas Indian classical music, it's kind of an acquired thing, and, you know, not that... It feels foreign to a lot of Westerners, but that power or that feeling, I feel like that's what has happened over these years. It's distilled in me and been able to somehow come out in the music.
So it's almost like, if I can imagine being you for a moment, it's as if you've learned a language or an art form that it is like a language that allows you to communicate with and invite into our presence the forms that are just behind the veil.
Yes. And
we hope you're enjoying today's program. You can find archives of A Shamanic Life and our other thoughtful and provocative programs at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Check out Convergence, John's monthly radio magazine where science and mysticism meet, the third Sunday of every month, or one of our other interesting shows and their interesting hosts, blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Come join us.
I love the work of my next guest. It's very physical, very visceral. Listen to a part of my conversation with Wendy Marie. It's not just about dancing. It's about being a fully embodied human being. Our featured guest is Wendy Marie, and I'm so excited to have Wendy on the show. Wendy is the founder of A Shamanic Disco, and it's Shamanic Disco and Ecstatic Dance of Silicon Valley. Wendy creates safe, sacred space for people to express themselves, be seen and heard using tribal technologies like conscious ecstatic dancing and wisdom circles. She holds dance events throughout Silicon Valley, and she is also the founder of Club Conscious, a safe space for community to come together and renew life by reconnecting through ritual with self and others. So, Wendy Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So when I hear you sharing about Club Conscious and what we create together, the couple of things that come up for me that are really special is that we're doing it as community and we're returning to a way of ritual. And that combination is so powerful. And it's part of a cultural shift in Silicon Valley. And it's needed for our communities, for people to return home to ourselves, and also to get connected with others.
So returning home to ourselves, that you, I hear you say that a lot. What does that mean to you?
I think it means having an opportunity to get really involved in that space of who I really am, and to do that in a safe space, to return home, to be fully expressed in a safe way, where I can touch into my anger, my regret, my guilt, my joy, my celebration of life, my gifts of who I really am. And coming home into that place is a solid, core, rich place to live life from. And we don't have that in the ordinary pace of life in our culture. We don't have a safe space to come home and express fully and then return back into our workplace, our relationships, our families, fully expressed. And we've come home, and now I can come home with you, and we can do this thing together. So it's a pretty rich experience to hold a space for people to come home.
So coming home, you know, when we come home from work, right? I mean, most of us have this experience where we hold it together pretty well at work, and then we come home, and that's when we let down our facade of civility and allow ourselves to be the wounded people we are, and we have fights with the people we love, right? I mean, we usually don't have fights at work, but we often have fights at home. Is that an unconscious way of coming home? I mean, maybe.
Yeah, so we're physically coming home to a place that I think would be awesome if it was set up as a sacred space when we're transitioning through that doorway, that we are transitioning and compassionately for ourselves first. And first thing that I heard you say was, we're holding it together. What did you say? We're holding it together pretty well at work. I think that is a belief system that most of us live in. We think it's real, that we're actually holding it together pretty well.
Okay.
Do you actually believe that? And people actually live life thinking that I got this together, I'm holding it together. What are you holding together? That's, to me, the question that we need to explore and spend some time. What are you holding together? What is our country holding together? What are we holding together at work? And what if we weren't holding it together? What would happen? Or what if we were holding it together in a different way? Is this way of being really serving us as individuals, as a country, as a world globally?
So let's
time to change that.
Let's ask that question. What are we holding together when we successfully navigate a day at work, or a week, or a month, or a year, 10 years? What are we holding together?
Yeah, and I feel my face and my teeth clenching up, my fists kind of, because I feel that a lot of people are putting a lot of energy and effort into holding something up that maybe doesn't feel in alignment for them, and there needs to be something else in there with it, you know, compassion and empathy and realness of people's feelings.
Well, I mean, let's give credit to what we actually are holding together, right? We're holding together the ability to feed our families, right? And
a lot of monetary.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, feed, clothe, shelter, educate, right? But you're right. We expend an extraordinary amount of energy that goes beyond those fundamental needs. And what is that? What is it that we're holding together?
A lot of distraction.
Is it? And it's a lot of, I mean, one of the reasons that ecstatic dance is so interesting, the shamanic disco that you put on, is that that's a place where you go to, where, you know, I think you encourage people to look at what you're not expressing, what you're holding, underwater, or holding, you know, keeping in your pocket or whatever, these tensions and stresses that compromise, that the not expressing those things compromises your experience as a human.
Yeah, I definitely feel that it comes out sideways if we don't spend some time and some energy consciously exploring those parts of ourselves. Those parts, that music, movement, the exploration of space and connection and gravity, bring up for us in a shamanic way, and you don't have to be skilled or taught how to do it. We're all in these bodies and we're all having a human experience and a spiritual experience. So creating a safe space where we can bring all of that together so that we can go back to work as a whole person, functioning in our wholeness. That's that piece about coming home.
Hmm. So you mentioned the notion that one of the things that we're doing besides taking care of our basic needs is distracting ourselves. What's the consequence of that?
Schizophrenia comes up for me, like this kind of schizo experience in life, you know, like you're hearing about so many people being medicated now, right, to cope with these symptoms. Instead of listening to the symptoms, we're being medicated. Calm your symptoms down, which is causing something else to go on. So we're constantly stuffing so that we can live into this concept that we're holding it together. Because if we don't, how are we going to feed our families?
Mm. Yeah, so we're not really holding it together.
I don't feel like we are. We are. There is a creating space where people can fully express, ride the arc, the full arc of human and spiritual experience.
Yeah, I think that's a big deal. You talk about that a lot, and I think it's kind of an essential part of the medicine that you bring, and that is that we have to ride the whole ride. We have to allow ourselves to feel the anger, the frustration, the dismay, the despair, the pain and the suffering, if we're going to understand what's really going on in our lives. And in our world, I guess.
It's an invitation to heal and recover. So if nobody else knows that's going on with me, and I can also stuff it through work or other addictions, it'll never get healed. It'll never be exposed. And I think one of the biggest things in our society is that we have to do this alone. And we're not alone. We're not alone. And in a conscious space, a sacred space where people are safe to express, you can start getting the reality that you're not alone. Others are feeling this. Others are experiencing this. Whoa, we're all human. Got it.
Mm.
We're living a human life together is what we're doing. And so having space to fully express brings people together. We start waking up. We start waking ourselves up. We start waking others up. So it's really waking people up, coming home to a full, fully expressed experience as a human body and a spiritual experience.
So, hi, this is John Carosella, your host for A Shamanic Life. I hope you're enjoying the show. I love creating this show and sharing our guests with you. If you'd like to support the show, your contributions in any amount are gratefully received. If you'd like to help, send your contribution via PayPal to asl@fireflywillows.com. That's asl@fireflywillows.com. Sincerely, and with love and light, I thank you. I first met Liz Addison very early in my new post-high-tech career. I was honored to have her on our very first show back in February for Spirit, Muse, and Song. And she was my featured guest on our June 4th show. Here's a snip of Hearts and Bones from her most recent album, followed by some of our June 4th conversation. Our featured guest tonight, Liz Addison, who is a magnificent vocalist, innovative composer, and creator of Kivo, a very fun, powerful, transformational dance. And transformational dance, is that what you call it?
Yeah, I like to consider that I'm using song or vocal and movement as transformational tools.
Mm.
But also just opportunities to have a good time.
And it is really a great time. It's really fun. And earlier we were talking about you started to investigate cultures that had the same word for song and dance.
And I remembered the Mende word is doyiga.
Doyiga.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a cool word.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a lot of them were in Africa. So you went to Africa.
I did.
Tell us about your trip to Africa.
I went to Africa because I had wanted to go since I was 5. And when my mother passed away, I inherited a little money, and I was able to go.
So since you were 5 years old, you wanted to go to Africa.
I didn't go.
What was the trigger?
Like, struggling artist, didn't have enough money to go, you know?
What was the thing inside you when you were little? Where did you feel that desire to go to Africa?
No, I just felt like I belonged there. We had a book on the table called The Tree Where Man Was Born by Peter Matheson.
Oh.
Big coffee table tree.
A book.
A book. Yeah. Coffee table tree. And also Jane Goodall was a factor in our lives.
Uh-huh.
I just loved her. But I was always almost more interested in the forest than the chimps.
Wow.
So I ended up going. I've been a member of the Greenbelt Movement, which was started by Wangari Maathai in 1978. Most phenomenal woman. I think she and Jane Goodall are probably my two heroines of my life. She was the first woman in Eastern Africa to receive her PhD, which she did in biology. And then she went on to start the Greenbelt Movement. And that organization has planted 60 million trees in Kenya alone, and it empowers women. It's taught them organic and sustainable methods of harvesting and planting, and, you know, keeps the soil on the earth and the water on the earth, because bringing the trees back, which were all cut down when the, you know, our people went in and planted tea and coffee cash crops. And
So what was that trip like?
So I organized 5 trips.
Oh,
and
really?
That was the only one that stuck. Everything just lined up and converged. It was going with the Greenbelt Movement in Kenya and Roots and Shoots, which is Jane Goodall's tree planting organization in Tanzania. And I wanted to go to Mount Kilimanjaro and the Serengeti and Mount Kenya. So it all just happened. That was really where I wanted to go. And
was this the only one that was focused on the trees?
Yeah, that's the only one I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning on going back, and you're welcome to come with me. We're going in July. Have a couple of projects there. One is to plant 1,000 trees in a school yard, because when I got there, there were about 250 kids playing with one soccer ball they'd fashioned out of T-shirts.
Wow.
And it was really dusty and dry.
Yeah.
So in order to give them some shade and some topsoil, we're going to plant 1,000 trees, and I'm taking donations for that. And then in Tanzania, they've asked me to return and start a Kivo Sew and Design Center to provide livelihood for women. And so I am also developing a little store there, and we will also be planting trees with every class that graduates.
Wow.
They taught me their songs and dances.
They
did. Everywhere I went, I was pulled into the villages, and they welcomed me with a Kivo-like celebration or welcoming song.
Did they know you were coming?
Well, of course they did, because I was communicating with the Greenbelt Movement and with Roots and Shoots and with a young man who started a safari company in Australia. And they set it all up for me. And we communicated by email. And I told them, yes, I want to do what you're offering, and I want to learn the songs and dances. And so they did. They set it up so I could.
That's fantastic.
It was phenomenal. It blew me away. I was in tears when I arrived, and I was in tears when I left. And just to be on the motherland of Africa, I cried. And to feel so welcome, and at home. And it was so joyful. And we were all, you know, singing and welcoming and dancing. And I just felt like I was at home. I was blown away.
Actually,
we communicate by Facebook every day now.
Did the songs and the chants and the rhythms also feel like they were familiar?
Yeah, they're easy to learn.
But were they exotic to you?
Tanzania, actually, I taught a day at a girls' school, and that was such a rush because the teacher had requested that I send one of my songs and choreography to him, and it was the most African, kind of a high life one, and the chant is the Mababwa, so it's honoring the Ma for the mother, the Ba for the Papa, and the Bwa for Bwana, respect. It's also a water element. Bois in French is to drink. So I'm showing them the choreography. You've got this section where the arms are opening and closing and opening and closing. And the girls say, Miss Addison, how did you know Swahili? I said, I didn't know Swahili. And they said, Mabawa. Mabawa means wings in Swahili, and we thought you knew because of the choreography. And I said, no, I didn't. So a lot of times I change that chant now from Mababwa to Mabawa. And I remember texting my husband going, well, I guess the spirits are having me channel Swahili now.
That's okay, man. That's so what
cool.
A beautiful synchronicity and powerful, too.
It was.
And you do this here.
I do.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing here.
Well, the work I'm doing here is I do a lot of Akashic Record consultations and soul path work, helping people find their soul path. And through that process, if we do a one-on-one, I often will do some clearing or energy healing with the sound and the movement. So it's a specially designed one-on-one program that I have.
Right.
And I've been focusing lately quite a bit on assisting people in finding their soul path and then voicing it in the world. Because I'm all about the voice, and it's important to me that we clear the blocks. A lot of times, you know, people will come in and I'll see where the block is. And so we'll do some chakra clearing with the sound and the movement and releasing. The record keepers are phenomenal with helping support that growth.
Mm.
And so they help, you know, guide me. And then the intention is to clear the physical and energy bodies using sound and movement and with the wisdom from the records. I also work a lot with animal totems and other practices of that nature. We do a lot of listening to the nature spirits, matching our voice to that, speaking that which maybe we are afraid to speak. So it's all about bringing the voice forward in the world, and particularly the voice of the feminine collective, which I feel is so important to have heard at this time in history. It's crucial for our survival. So I'm really interested in helping women find their soul path, get in touch with their voice, clear the old traumas, and come forward and speak their truth, claim their space, own their worth.
So that brings up a couple of questions for me. One is, what is the nature of that voice that's coming forward? What does it sound like?
It's not one thing. Because the collective is comprised of individual voices. So it's each woman accessing her wisdom, harnessing the power of her voice, which is the sacred vibration that she came with, accessing that wisdom and voicing it, speaking in the world. And sometimes it's just important for women to be heard, because collectively, we have been shut down through lifetimes, for centuries. You know, we've been beheaded.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuck energy in the collective voice of the female and in the personal voice of the female.
Yeah.
I work with a lot of women who say, oh, I was, you know, 12 or 13, right at puberty, right? And some choir director or teacher or coach or somebody said, you can't sing, just mouth the words. Just mouth the words. So basically they're saying, you're not important, you don't count, shut up. Ah! And it's men too. I've heard that from men too. And I'm sorry if that has happened to you. Because we carry that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, the belittling you might have had as a child. I mean, it's subtle stuff, but it resounds. It's time.
Oh, yeah.
It's just time to let all that go. And my gifts are one way that's needed at this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other question I wanted to ask you about, which I think you kind of answered, is do you do this work for men as well?
I do.
And do you sense a gender-oriented difference in the blockages or the trend lines of what the women are dealing with versus what the men are dealing with?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I just got this awareness, and partly from what you said. The men have a greater difficulty, I would say, in moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the freedom of movement.
Us gawky guys on the dance floor. So women have greater freedom of movement, and men have greater freedom of voice.
I see. The freedom. Yes.
Yes.
Women most likely have more freedom moving the body.
Right.
And men have more freedom
speaking.
Vocalizing.
Yeah.
I would say that's pretty cool. I never noticed that. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
The light bulb.
So I was asking you about what's the sound of the communal feminine.
Collective.
The collective feminine.
The voice of the collective.
The voice of the collective. It sounds like the one thing that we can say is it needs to be heard. One generalization we can make is that it needs to be heard.
And valued. And valued. Honored. Because it's the voice, you know, we're embodied. We women, we give birth.
Oh, yeah.
It's the voice of the earth speaking.
Yeah.
Speaking the pain and the victimization.
Every once in a while, I have the opportunity to share some of my daughter's work in the sensory experience. Here's Gina Carosella talking with me about A Hint of Rain at Night. This is A Shamanic Life. And we're here with Gina Carosella for the sensory experience. And what have you got for us this time?
Today we have the first of what will probably be a series of still quiet moments. And these are sensory experiences that aren't a particular thing like rosemary or a particular event like Lost Pines at Night. These are just taking a moment, being outside, and seeing what's around.
Oh, okay. So these are, in a way, they're kind of, they're very yin, because you're not actually searching or actively experiencing, you're just receiving.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right, and what do we got?
So today's still quiet moment is A Hint of Rain at Night.
Now, last time you did something about rain.
Yes. Last...
That was late winter rain or something.
Late season rain, yes.
Late season rain, right. So how is this different?
Late season rain, I was out for a walk. I was searching out different things. I was exploring a little bit more. This one, I was just letting it happen.
Okay. And what did you come away with?
One of the larger features of this particular experience was actually more the wind than the rain.
Oh.
The wind was blowing rather briskly that evening, and so the primary sensory experience for this piece was sound.
Oh, okay. All right, well, that'll be interesting to hear about. Okay, is there anything else you want to share before you actually give us the experience?
No, I think we're good.
All right, so well then why don't you share with us a still quiet moment, A Hint of Rain at Night.
A still quiet moment, a hint of rain at night. The breeze is cold, winter not yet surrendering to the creep of the seasons. It plays over my skin, raising goosebumps and drawing out a shiver. The fountain grass hisses as it moves, long golden blades swaying. It seems restless, not like the trees. The pistache tree whispers cheerfully, a few red-orange salmon leaves falling from among the healthy green. The pistache cares little for the changing of the seasons. The great old pine creaks, its joints weary with age, as it grumbles under its breath. Tiny touches of cold fall against my upturned face. One raindrop lands in a perfect kiss upon my lower lip. It is bitter against my tongue, the taste heavy with whatever imperfection called it down from the clouds. The plum blossoms bloom white and bright against the darkness. They shine and twist in the wind, and the bitter brown smell of chartreuse pollen tickles unpleasantly in my nose. There is pollen everywhere, layered on leaves and stones and cars. Bruised purple clouds obscure most of the stars, but a few pinpricks of white shine through. Clear and bright and cold as the wind.
There's so much more that we couldn't share tonight. Guests, music, concepts. It's been a really great first season. I'd like to thank all my guests and especially Karen Armstrong, Shamanic Life Online Community founder and my dear friend, without whom this show would not exist. We're going to take some time off. We'll be back September 3rd. Until then, enjoy the archives and enjoy your summer. Join us on the Shamanic Life Facebook page, facebook.com/shamaniclife. Share your thoughts and ideas. It's a new world out there, and we're all shaping it one day at a time by choosing to live the shamanic life. So finally tonight, our special guest, Todd Boston, for Spirit, Muse, and Song. Todd is an accomplished guitarist and Native American flute player. His most recent album, Touched by the Sun, was produced by Windham Hill Records founder and New Age music icon Will Ackerman. This is called Celtic Heart. Thanks so much for listening.
That was Celtic Heart from Todd Boston's latest album, Touched by the Sun. And we are lucky and privileged to have Todd with us, joining us on the program tonight. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Todd, I just discovered your music recently. It is very cool. I love this album, Touched by the Sun. But you've been playing and performing for a while now, yeah?
I have. I started playing music at a very young age. My mother got me piano lessons, which I'm always grateful for. And that started me on a path and a love of music. When I was a teenager, I picked up the guitar, and that kind of changed my life forever. And, ever since then, I've been discovering what music means to me and how I can express it and share it with others.
Well, on that note, what music means to you, I took a listen to a couple of tracks from Urban Nature Coming Home, which was your 2008 collaboration with Ramesh Kennan.
Yep.
And Alive, which was your first solo album, which you published in 2010. And your music is definitely changing.
It is changing.
Tell us about that path, that arc of change.
Well, the album Coming Home with my dear friend Ramesh Kennan, who also is on both Alive and Touched by the Sun. He and I currently tour with an artist named Sonatam Kaur, who is a singer. And
we're going to talk about her in a minute.
Great. And so we're very connected still. But the album Coming Home was really a fusion of our creative spirits from the beginning to the end. You know, we really came together as co-collaborators and created an album of music that we wanted to express without any limitations and without any thoughts of what was possible or not. We just kind of set out to make an album, and it was self-produced. And then Ramesh began touring with Sonatam, and I veered off and did this album Alive, which was an expression of more of my live performances, where I was utilizing the guitar and some percussion and flutes and looping technology and performing that live. And so I wanted to bring that flavor into the studio and express that through an album. And moving into Touched by the Sun, that was a huge opportunity to work with amazing producer Will Ackerman.
Yeah, yeah.
And man, you know, all of a sudden you're in his world with his expertise and his brilliant ears. And then you also have his connections of all the musicians that he loves and loves to work.
Yeah, that can't hurt.
That can't hurt. So you talk about the music progressing. Well, all of a sudden, let's bring 5 Grammy winning artists into the project. And, you know, all of a sudden you've taken this music that I've been creating for a while and really literally put it on steroids. I mean, it just goes to another level.
So. Yeah. Well, so, you know, I listened to your conversation with Stephen Halpern, and you talked about the influence of Will Ackerman as a producer. Would you share that with us?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, there's so much to say, but Will is a brilliant producer because he expresses so much through an emotional place.
Hmm.
And what I really love about him is on a technical side, his quality of sound is second to none. I mean, when you listen to any of the Windham Hill Records stuff there was always this quality to the recordings and the production that's exceptional. But what Will does that I think is so special is he really has an emphasis on the emotive quality of the music. And as an artist, to be in that space with him, where he is so tuned in to your emotional expression in that moment, that even if you had a technically proficient take on one of the tracks or something, but you weren't feeling it, your heart wasn't in it, you know, he'll call you out on that. And he'll get, you know, and he might crack a joke, or, you know, he might just be very straightforward, you know, whatever it is, whatever his methods are. He really has a gift at getting this emotive quality out of the artist and the musician. And to me, that's kind of the blessing of working with a producer on that caliber.
Mm.
As the artist, the musician, you really just are all of a sudden in this cocoon of sorts where all you have to do is go into your heart and play your heart out, and everything else is being taken care of. And so you can just play and let that person say, that was it, or, hey, let's do it again.
Yeah, and presumably he captures your trust in a way that allows you to feel free and safe to play your heart out.
And that's a journey in life, right? I mean, gosh, we just tapped into something we could probably talk about for hours is trust, right? And the unique part of that experience with Will and my experience with him was that he and I really had to go through a level of trust building that was kind of pre-production before we got into the studio. We went through a whole experience together where we were really able to develop a deeper level of trust. And it, you know, at one point he said to me from his years of expertise and wisdom, hey, Todd, I don't feel like you're trusting me here. I don't feel like you're allowing me to really bring everything that I can to the table here and help you to bring this music to a higher level. And he called me out on that as a friend in a really good way and allowed me to self-reflect and, you know, kind of really go into that place inside and say, am I trusting him? How can I trust him more? Why am I not trusting him? So it became this whole interpersonal experience that the end result of that was a great level of trust and a great level of connection between him as the producer and myself as the artist, which then allowed Touched by the Sun to go to the level that it did.
Mm, yeah. It's an amazing testament to the power of trust. I mean, I think the album is so beautiful. And if it was the capacity for you guys to trust each other that facilitated that happening, I think that's a great example.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it definitely was. I had no foresight that was going to become such a part of it. But it really, you know, when you brought it up, it really dawned on me and it was a reflection for me of how deeply that the layers of trust allowed us to then push the edges and really go for it with the album, you know. And it wouldn't have been what it was if we're kind of working that out in the studio, you know, but fortunately we kind of worked that out before we ever got there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I went in trusting him fully. I said, listen, you're the man. You show me where to go. You tell me where to go and I'll go there. And because of that, he would turn to me and say, Todd, where do you think we should go now?
Yeah.
You know, and it worked out this really beautiful collaboration. And the fortunate part is that I'm happy that I can call Will a friend at this point, and he and I have really become close through the process, and that's the biggest gift of all.
Yeah, well, it's something I wanted to touch on with respect to the creation of music in general, and it was really interesting to me in hearing about the role of the producer as you just had described it. You know, music can be this beautifully collaborative, co-creative experience.
Mm-hmm.
And musicians, as you get in the groove, so to speak, that groove is a groove of trust and cross leverage, kind of. You know, it's like you lean on one another's strengths, you lean on one another's energy to manifest something magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is that a part of your musical development, and how do you carry that into your spiritual development, your spiritual life, and how does your spiritual life, your spiritual development carry into your music?
Hmm. To me, they're one and the same. Definitely my, say, spiritual life and musical life, you know, are deeply interwoven and connected. And the collaborative side of music, I think music is always a collaboration on some level, even if you're, say, sitting in your living room all alone and recording a song or playing music, there's still this collaboration that's happening with the world around you, the room that you're in, the nature outside your door, the people close by. I mean, there's so many levels of it.
The instrument itself.
You know, for me, nature is a huge inspiration, and just the nature around me sometimes can be such a collaborative force and a collaborative energy. And I think collaboration, it pushes our relationships and connections to self-love, to trust, to being our best. I mean, all these levels of human development and interpersonal spiritual development. And so music, I've always felt like music is this great teacher that a large portion of life lessons can be drawn to analogies within music. And, you know, it's a very vulnerable and exposing thing to go out there and create something and offer it. And so I feel that when you're in that collaborative spirit and energy with other musicians or the environment that you're in, you know, you really have to listen. You really have to go to a deep place of being open and listening.
And you listen, you don't just listen with your ears or even with your heart. You listen with your whole body, don't you?
It's very true. I mean, I think the art and the science of it is exactly, you nailed it. It's when you listen from your whole experience. And, you know, I think talking about, again, the analogies of, you know, human to human relationship, if, you know, you meet somebody and if you're listening to your body, like you said, and you feel how that person makes you feel, or, you know, maybe it's a particular situation and you have a gut instinct, or, you know, you feel uncomfortable. Our bodies talk to us in so many ways. And it really is a huge part of the process is that fully engaged listening in your body and through your ears, of course, but, you know, your intuition as well.
Yeah. Now, was music a part of your spiritual life and your spirituality part of your musical life back when you were taking piano lessons?
Well, when I was young, I would say that I had kind of an idyllic young life. We lived in the country. My parents were happily married, you know, two kids and a dog. It was kind of an idyllic situation. And at one period of time, you know, in my young teenage years, my parents split ways and went through a divorce, and things went from being idyllic to a bit more chaotic, I would describe it as. Mm. And when things started to shift in my own life, and the stability around me became the opposite, became unstable, I think as a young person, I was grabbing for things that felt stable. And one of the things was nature for me. Something that was always grounding and healing is if I'd take a walk in nature, I would feel better. And the other side of that is music. And music really became a strong healing force for me when I felt sad or down, or, you know, in a moment of anger or chaos, whatever it is. What I was discovering as a young person, if I would sit down and play the guitar for an hour or 4 hours, for sometimes 8 hours. And whenever there are these moments where I would say, come out of it, or, you know, come back to the real world. And what I realized is that in that process, I transformed this energy of anger or sadness or grief or whatever it was. And what I thought was, or what I felt was so hard before, didn't seem so as much after a few hours of playing music. Amazing. I mean, to me, it's the brilliance of music, you know, and what its potential is. And as the course of my life developed with music, I started to realize that, you know, as a kind of a conscious, logical thing, oh, when I feel down, I play music, it helps me to feel better. And then throughout my life, I've really sought for the spiritual connection in music the more I grew and developed, which led me more into Indian music and kind of the music of the East and world music and these different stylings of music where I found this direct spiritual connection through the lineages and cultures that were expressing this forms of music.
Now, you're on tour and you're going to be in Watsonville, Santa Cruz area coming up on the 19th and 20th of July. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. This is a kind of a workshop format, and working with the singers Sanatam Kaur and Ramesh Kannan. And we are doing it's a 3-day, you know, kind of an immersive workshop that is really deeply about the music and about chanting. Sanatam Kaur that I've been working with. She is really committed in a beautiful way to the power of mantra and to sharing that with people. And she does so in a very beautiful way that really touches people's hearts. And it's a real joy and honor to, you know, to play music with her and to create, co-create together with Ramesh. And we have a lot of fun with it. And so the workshop will be about, like I said, 2 or 3 days of a very immersive musical chanting experience.
And they can, folks can find that, they can find the details on that workshop either on Todd's website, toddboston.com, or at spiritvoyages.com. So
Mount Madonna Center, which I've heard is beautiful.
So. Yeah, it's very nice up there. That's a beautiful part of the Northern California Bay Area. You do mantra music and music for yoga. What is going on for you? How does your muse interact with the focused attention on a particular yogic practice or yogic mood or mantra?
Well, it really goes back to what we talked about earlier with listening. I find that that's a crucial part of my experience with it is how deeply can I listen to what's going on around me? You know, and that's visual, it's auditory, it's what you feel, all these things that we talked about a little bit. And it's a very improvisational thing because the teacher is improvising. And so in that experience as the musician, I'm put in a situation where I'm there to support for this prolonged period of time in a very improvisational manner. And so it's actually a great practice of sitting down, opening my heart, listening really deeply, and then just playing from the heart. And it's really, for me, it's been almost miraculous at times, actually what comes out of that spontaneity and that collaboration. And some of the piece that you played earlier, the Celtic Heart, in fact, was a yoga class that I was involved with. And there was over 500 people in this particular class. And the energy was just very powerful. And this little melody of the Celtic Heart is something that came out of the spontaneity of a moment. And when I brought that idea to Will in the studio as in a pre-production session we were having, and I said, you know, I've got this little melody and here it is. What do you think? And he loved it, you know, and really felt that it was a solid piece, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. So we're going to go out on from the same album, Touched by the Sun. We're going to go out on the song Full Moon. Can you share a little bit about what we're going to hear and what motivated that?
Sure. This is a piece that I've been expressing in different forms for a number of years now. And I would say the composition in its early forms is about 10 years old. And for me, music is always evolving. I mean, tomorrow it can evolve into being something new. And this is a song that really evolved when it was time to record it in Touched by the Sun in a beautiful way. And it's really about the power of the moon, is the inspiration of the full moon. It's a very, it's a rajastic or fiery song. It has a lot of passion to it, I think. And it's the mystery of the nighttime and the energy that the moon can stir in us. And the piece has brilliant violin by a great player named Charlie Bisharat, and beautiful drums by my friend Ramesh, and great bass playing by Michael Manrain. So, I mean, these guys are
stars. These are players, yeah.
World-class musicians. And so to be able to bring this composition and put it in their hands and let them work their magic with it, it's one of my favorite pieces. I was really glad that you chose it because I just think it's a beautiful collaboration, as we were talking about earlier. It really... Mm-hmm. It's a nice composition to begin with, but the energy that came into it from the musicians is really what makes it special.
Yeah. Okay. So, Todd, for folks who want to get to know you and your work a little bit better, we send them to
toddboston.com. That's T-O-D-D and then Boston, like the city in Massachusetts.
toddboston.com. All right. And for those of us who are in the Bay Area, you have a chance to see Todd down at the Realign Into the Light Festival in Watsonville on the weekend of the 19th through the 21st. Todd, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, John. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate it.
And this is Full Moon from Todd's album, Touched by the Sun.